WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. That's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it's really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. Thank you for tuning in to Monday Night Talk. This, of course, is a very special edition because, A, it is 4th of July. Happy Independence Day. As well, we have a very special program. Actually, we're going to be having live coverage coming from the Plymouth waterfront, courtesy of the Plymouth Philharmonic Orchestra, being brought to you by Ed Perry, Larry Nelson, who will give you coverage down there. That'll be taking place again at the top of the hour. Right now, we have programming here. We have conversations that'll take place here for the next 45 minutes. My guests, I thought that it was proper to have guests that, you know, somehow had something with the holiday, had something to do with our nation and things that are happening currently in our country. We start things with a segment that I've done annually for the past few years, and that's inviting in Plymouth County Sheriff Joe McDonald. Oh, other than being a county lawman and overseeing the sheriff's department, is also admittedly a student of American history. And we're going to talk a little bit about the 4th of July versus Independence Day. The Declaration of Independence, story behind it. Also, a couple of other historical nuggets. So stay tuned for that. Then we will have Chris DiOrio join us. Chris was on just after running the Boston Marathon, but he's more than a marathon runner and a fundraiser. He is an attorney here locally on the South Shore and someone who specializes in constitutional law. So this is that we could talk with Chris about the recent news about the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. What, you know, how this took place. Is this something that we'll see, you know, other changes? Will there be other decisions by the justices down the road? And are there, you know, is this law for the next 50 years that we're going to see individual states making laws in regards to abortion rights because it's no longer something that is a constitutional right for a woman to do what she wants with her body? We'll talk with Chris about that in just a couple of moments. But right now, time for us to take a look at your holiday traffic. Being brought to you on this and Brennan Smoke Shop with locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stowe, New Bedford, Weymouth, and now Hudson, New Hampshire.
Hey, it's Jeff from Brennan's. Did y'all know people all over the world celebrate the 4th of July? Not because we fought and won our independence. It's our idea of freedom. Having somewhere you can practice whatever religion. Somewhere to work, play, and raise a family in peace. No matter what race, religion, or creed. We truly live in the best country on this speck of dust called Earth. I say idea because we clearly have work to do. We, the people of the United States of America. The 4th of July has always been my favorite holiday.
I hope it's my kids' favorite as well.
Brennan's Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, Weymouth, Hudson, New Hampshire. Brennan's Smoke Shop, the best smoke shop in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. Customers must be 21 years of age or older, and proper ID is required.
Follow Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Joining us on this day so happens to be a gentleman who I love having a conversation with. It's a timely chat that we're going to have, and that is none other than Plymouth County Sheriff Joe McDonald. Sheriff, welcome back to the show.
Well, Kevin, it's a great pleasure to be here. Whenever I'm with you, I feel truly with a kindred spirit, someone who enjoys history and those obscure facts, unfortunately obscure facts, that and so fascinating.
It's worth asking if, would you say you are a student of American history?
I would say that, yes, I am a student of American history. In the past, before I was, and actually for a little short while I was the sheriff, I used to teach adjunct professor at Quincy College, the Plymouth campus, and there I was able to share my love of history. I taught history there and criminal justice. So history, criminal justice, I did a constitutional law class or two and enjoyed that tremendously. And I think when I retire from the office of sheriff, which hopefully isn't any time, that I'll be able to return and be able to do that at least part-time. It's fun.
What would you say are your favorite periods of time that regardless of when we're out, you'd like you go back and you'll look at periods of time as our nation was in its infancy?
Yeah, you know, that's a very difficult question to answer. But what I would say that the highlights for me, obviously early colonial periods, you know, the Pilgrims and King Philip. And this is largely because that's where we live. This is what happened. We're here, or where we are. And jump, you know, from that, the French and Indian War. These are the things, you know. America is many, many things. It's an amalgam of so many wonderful things and terrible things. And you know, our story, the best story, is the true story. And how it is we got to sit right here. Is such an interesting thing. You know, the French and Indian War and the debt that was incurred in Great Britain, which caused the taxation issue, which caused the colonists to get, and leading directly, really, to the American Revolution, which made us an independent country. And then, you know, jumping ahead to 1860, the election of Abraham Lincoln, the American Civil War, a terrible conflict, but, you know, the country came out of it changed for the better, and you know, it really, I think it brings home who we are and how this nation evolves. And that's one of the things, you know, we never to be perfect, but I think we can certainly lay claim to being the best, no question. And we get better every day.
The main purpose for our conversation, the discussion, is the misconception around America's birthday or the holiday. So many people call it, oh, the July 4th holiday. But that's wrong, isn't it?
That is wrong, and what you have identified, and you know this because you know me, this is a pet peeve of mine, is so many people will come to me, they will see me, and they'll say, Happy 4th of July. And my response to them, I've conditioned myself now to, when they say Happy 4th of July, that's not what I hear. I hear Happy Independence Day. But my response to them is always, and a Happy Independence Day to you. Because that really is what we are celebrating on July 4th. It is the birth of the United States, American independence.
How is this so much confusion? I mean, when was the Declaration of Independence actually minted and signed?
Indeed, Kevin. Those are also great questions, you know. And we all learned in high school, and myself included, that, you know, in Congress, July 4th, 1776, says so right on the top of the document, right? Right there. But it's wrong. And what do I mean by that? How can I agree with one of the most sacred secular documents have in the, you know, our foundation, really. And the story of it is an interesting one. And I think that a lot of people, when they hear me that the 4th of July is not our Independence Day, or at least not the actual Independence Day, people up and they take notice. Well, what do you mean by that? I've seen the Declaration of Independence or the copy of it. And what it means is this. You know, there was a lot of consternation may not be the right word, but when you think about how brave those delegates were to the Continental Congress who put their names on that document, eventually signed, and the document itself really wasn't signed until early August of that year, 1776. What's interesting to note also, and you know, the document itself, the initial draft, was written by Thomas Jefferson. Historians agree to that. Even, you know, if you read primary source, they all tell you Thomas Jefferson wrote it. But he sought the input of John Adams of Boston, of Quincy, and Benjamin Franklin of Philadelphia. So Ben Franklin and Adams had a hand in helping Jeff tighten this up, and that was given back to him, and he made this. But the vote for independence in that Continental Congress didn't take place on July 4th. The vote actually, it was brought forward at the end of June by Richard Henry Lee of Virginia, and it was known as the Lee proposition, you know, and Lee's position was, you know, he wanted that vote. It was, you can imagine, that when got this Lee resolution forward, that, you know, people were somewhat, you know, I know that they agreed with this probably in principle, but to put their name, this was high treason. And this was the Second Continental Congress. Now, the First Continental Congress, their whole goal, or the really, I think what most of them wanted to do, was make reconciliation with Great Britain. Mm. And I think at this point in time, we realized that that probably wasn't such a big option. But Lee put forth his resolution, and it was debated some period of time until the 2nd of July, when the vote was taken in the Second Continental Congress, which was, the president of that was John Hancock, who appears very large on the document, as we know. So that vote took place July 2nd, and it passed July 2nd. All colonies voted for that. All the colonies save one, and that would be the colony of New York. They actually abstained. And you think to yourself, my God, well, if everyone was for this, why did they abstain? And the reason they abstained, the representatives from the state of New York, is they had not received authorization from their state legislature to vote in favor of something like this. So it tells you, you know, that as passionate as they were tempered by their thoughts of responsibility to the folk. So it really was July the 2nd that independence was declared by the Second Continental Congress.
And again, if you're just tuning in, we are privileged to be speaking with Plymouth County Sheriff Joe McDonald, a self-professed historian, no, I should say, but a student of history, yes, American yes. history, and any chance that I have to sit down and talk about it, especially this time of year, I seize that opportunity. You mentioned about John Hancock and how big his signature was. Was it ever told as to why he made his signature so big on that document? Was it by design or purpose?
I think that Hancock's signature was by design in all aspects. It's penmanship is exquisite. There's no, I mean, what a great that he had. You can imagine that he took his time when he did that. He signed it in the middle. He was the president of the Second Continental Congress, and he wanted that to be known. And there's a great argument made that Hancock was actually our first president because he was the president of the Continental Congress at the time that we, you know, there was no executive branch. So I think there's a good argument. You know, that's another, that's a show for another day, who's the first president, right? But yeah, I think the placement, the size of it being much larger, and the fact that, you know, I really admire because, as we said, every signatory to this document, every person that signed it, was declaring not only our independence, but they were declaring their treason to the crown of Great Britain. So, in a sense, they were signing their own death warrant had we not won the revolution.
It's interesting that another little nut I always have enjoyed us talking a little bit about is that July 4th so signifies the passing of two individuals who are part of that historical document, Thomas Jefferson and Adams.
Yes, and you know, as we know, Thomas Jefferson was the author of the initial document, and I think largely of really the whole document. had a lot of help from Adams in making the edits, and Ben Franklin as well. And they were, you know, at the time of the founding, they were friends, they were colleagues. And over time, as the New Republic fledged, they became political rivals and ultimately political. And again, that could be a story for another day. Interesting to note is that, I hesitate to use the word enemies, but they have a falling out. And over the years, that falling out was repaired because I think their better nature prevailed. And that them, although, you know, Adams lived in Quincy and you had Jefferson, Virginia, they would correspond. They wrote letters to each other back and forth and reestablished their friendship through those letters. And what's interesting, I think what you're driving at here is the other, you know, there are, in my experience, there are not many coincidences. You know, things happen for a reason most of the time. And you jump forward 50 years to the day, 1826, July the 4th, both of those individuals died. Thomas Jefferson died in the early morning hours in Virginia at Monticello, and John Adams died in Quincy. And it, although they don't know necessarily what Jefferson's final words were, they know what John Adams' final words were. And John Adams' final words were chilling. Jefferson survives. You know, think about that. Now, there was no way at that time that they'd have known that Jefferson in Virginia had predeceased him.
Right.
But his last words were about Jefferson. And you know, I've thought about words and what did he mean by that? And what I like to think is my interpretation of this, and I think anybody that figures this may come to a similar or even a different conclusion, but I think what he meant when he said that Jefferson survives is he meant that the Republic survives through the words of Jefferson that he helped to create. I think what he was doing was reaffirming his commitment to the strength of the United States. And deeper words have not been spoken that I'm aware of. I mean, just an amazing turn of events.
So going back to our main focus on this day, and that's what can be done for folks to get a better understanding of our independence, this document that basically was the antithesis to us being a free nation from Great Britain. For folks to have a better understanding, is it just a matter of getting the word out and doing stuff like this?
Well, I think there's a lot of great books about this period, and in particular, I should have brought a bibliography with me because I've got no less than 11 or 12 on my bookshelf at home. There was one that was, it's the title is Miracle at Philadelphia, something like that. But there's a number of books out there that people can and should read because they're so interesting about this period. And when you think about these nuances that we're speaking about here, there's actually sometimes a bit of humor in these things. Sometimes it's the coincidences that happen, like you say yourself, wow, that shouldn't have. But it's interesting. I brought here, and I wanted to excerpt it because I want to get the wording wrong.
Please do.
One of the things that the title of this book is Dearest Friend, if people want to. And Dearest Friend is a collection of the letters between John Adams and Abigail Adams. John was writing while he was away at the Congress. And he and Abigail, and many historians, probably myself included, that as John Adams was, Abigail was half again more brilliant. She was really, and he relied upon her. But I would just do a little excerpt of a letter that he wrote to Abigail on July the 3rd of 1776, talking about American events. The second day of July, 1776, will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with show, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illumination from one end of this continent to the other from this time forward forever. And he had everything really accurate predicted, didn't he? With one exception, 2 days off.
Right.
But I think it's great, you know.
One other little tidbit before we wrap everything up. Prior to us having this conversation, you had also shared a little state nugget in regards to being independent, and that is that Massachusetts, as it has always throughout history, leading the nation when it comes to certain things, actually maybe was the start of independence, but a few years earlier here in Massachusetts.
Right, Kevin. Yeah, and you know, one of the things that travel, I tell people, you know, that I am from Plymouth County, and everyone knows that Plymouth calls America's hometown, and I think as a county, we can really lay claim to that as well. We are really the birthplace of America. American, you know, started here, declared independence here. So much of what his country, what it is, started right here, you know, miles from where we're sitting right now. And, you know, what I'm talking about, you know, it starts from the earliest days of the colony, what their purposes were. But what you're referring to, I think, is, you know, what people may not be aware of, the first Declaration of Independence in the United States or the New World was here in Massachusetts on October 7th of 1774. And I'll tell you a quick funny story after this about a constitutional law class that I taught. The issue was, but it's interesting to note that very quickly, after the Boston Tea Party, which was a very significant event in December of 1773, Massachusetts was martial law, and our legislature, you know, were allowed by the crown to have self-government. You know, we didn't have representation, but we had our own governments here in America. The British placed us after the Tea Party under martial law, intolerable acts, and, you know, they quartered British troops in our homes and that. But they really exercised control. Well, a good rebel would be, you know, here in Massachusetts, we took our legislature, our general court, as it is called, it is called today, and they left Boston and met somewhere else, but they continued their business of government. So on this date, October 7th, they happened to be meeting in Concord, and they declared and, you know, voted the declaration of the independence of Massachusetts as a free and independent state. October 7, 1774, so signed before July 2nd of 1776. So we actually, Massachusetts, declared our independence before the country.
Wow.
And the other interesting quick story, which I will share with you, at Quincy College, I did teach a constitutional law class, which I enjoyed. The thing I didn't enjoy was I didn't get to pick my own textbook. So, you know, I always bring things because I like to give them to people if they are interested in reading more. The dean said, can you look at the textbook and just tell me what you think? So I took the book, I opened it up, and I read the first line of the introduction, and I closed it, and I gave it back, and I said, I don't like it. And she says, well, you didn't even get it. Why? How can you say you don't like this book? I said, well, with all due respect to the authors and to the, you know, people that worked hard to get this book to me, I read the first line introduction, and it is wrong. And she said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, read it. The Constitution of the United States, the oldest continuously governing document in the world.
Is that true?
And she said, well, what's wrong with that? That's true. I said, it is not.
Nope.
I said, the oldest continuously governing constitution in the world is the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And it that is also a thing of beauty. If you've never had a chance to page through that, the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts was the model for the federal constitution in that it included not just the body of the Constitution, but rights. We had the Declaration of Rights. So, and that was a big debate at the time, whether or not we should include that. So, and I said to her about this, the Constitution of the Commonwealth is 1780. You can read it. The Constitution of the United States of America didn't get passed, come into existence 1787 and finally ratified in 1789. So, interesting. So as we state our Independence Day celebrations, I think it's fitting. I don't know how we're doing for time, but yeah. So what I would like to do is, you know, just share with people what it is, you know, the significance of that act. The final line of the Declaration of Independence, and I want to make sure that I get it because I don't want to misquote
Correct.
This. Think of the strength and the courage required to add your name to this document. And for the support of this declaration, firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And more of that, Kevin. I can't think we could ask for more, could we?
Could not. And I couldn't ask for a better to do this particular segment. I thank you and for being a guest at this time of year to talk about.
Oh, thank you.
Independence Day.
We're going to step aside for a moment. When we come back, the final segment of Monday Night. Stay tuned.
What is AA?
Alcoholics Anonymous is an international fellowship of people who have had a drinking problem.
It is non-professional and self-supporting.
AA is multiracial, apolitical, and available almost everywhere.
There are no age or education requirements. Membership is open to anyone who wants to do something about their drinking problem.
For more information, literature, and videos about Alcoholics Anonymous, and to find a meeting near you, visit AA.org. Alcoholics Anonymous has a solution.
Hi, my name is Alex Bazantin, and I'm running for Plymouth County Commissioner. I am the former chairman of the Abington Conservation Commission, former Abington Water Commissioner, and now serving in my second term as Abington Selectman. I am currently serving on the executive board of the Plymouth County Advisory Board. If you would like to learn more about my candidacy, please visit my website at alexbazantin.org or follow me on Facebook. I am Alex Bazantin for Plymouth County Commissioner, and I approve this message.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Okay, so we're back for yet another segment. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
Joining us today for this timely chat is a gentleman who you know, stranger to. His name is Chris DiOrio. He is an attorney. And he specializes in several areas of the law that includes civil rights, human rights. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Good to be here.
Is it fair to say, this is my opening softball question to you, that you are very well studied when it comes to constitutional law and the inner workings of the federal government?
I've been teaching constitutional law locally for about 11 years now. And as a person who works in the civil rights field, as part of my practice, you've got to know what the book says in order for you to be able to talk about it. So you can say that I'm well-versed in the area, yes.
So the primary focus of our discussion is to take a look at the actions of the Supreme Court, who actually recently overturned the 1973 landmark decision known as Roe versus Wade.
Correct.
That ruled that the Constitution of the United States generally protects the a woman's liberty to have an abortion. For those who have no idea actually what that means, or what this decision means, maybe they don't fully understand it. What does it mean?
Sure. Roe is a 1973 decision, as you said, that enshrined a woman's right to choose to terminate her pregnancy. The decision itself was an oddly written decision, not necessarily the best piece of judicial craftsmanship, but the theory behind it, sometimes something you get there by difficult means, but the result is what's important. And it piggybacked off a previous case, Griswold versus Connecticut from 1965, that enshrined a right to privacy in general related to issues related to contraception and things of that nature. From Griswold, we then get Roe. Since 1973, there has been an onslaught of cases that have attempted to limit Roe, specifically in 1992, in the case that really is the solid precedent that the folks on the court were going after, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, where a plurality in protected Roe and created what they referred to as the undue burden standard, that laws that are created that deal with a woman's right to choose cannot create an undue burden on that right. And that's what Casey said in upholding Roe. Roe was written with what they refer to as a trimester system that acknowledged two separate rights. One, that a woman had a right to choose. But secondly, that a state had a right to protect life. The issue then became, where does the state's interest begin and where does the woman's interest end? Or at least, where can the state begin to encroach? And that's what Roe did. Roe had a trimester system that said for the first trimester, the first 3 months of a woman's pregnancy, no laws at all can affect the woman's right to choose. And then when you get to months 4 through 6, then the state can begin to intrude. And from 6 on, the state can ban it entirely. Casey removed that trimester system, per se, and then said a woman has a right to choose up to the point of viability. You know, the look on your face is where the confusion comes, and where does viability begin and end? It's a scientific question, also a moral question. And that's what in the majority opinion in Dobbs just recently referred to this this complex issue and this nature of morality versus science. And where do we begin to draw the line in terms of viability, or if we have a viability question at all?
I think the next two questions would be, first,
okay,
what effect will it have nationally?
The Dobbs decision by the Supreme Court, the 5-4 decision, that stated that the Constitution itself does not protect abortion. They took great pains in the majority decision to try to limit it, to just say that there is no constitutional right to abortion, that it is not protected as a fundamental right, as is your right to free speech, your right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure, all of those things that we believe as fundamental, that abortion was not mentioned as something that was protected fundamentally. So they now say that Roe is no longer good law. That's what happens when you overturn something. You can limit a case by, or limit a standard by, taking little pieces out of it. They outright said Roe is no longer good law. What that means is now it throws everything both into a federal tizzy and to a state's rights question. Because now, by eliminating Roe, now individual states are left to determine whether or not they're going to codify the right to choose into law, or whether they are going to go the complete opposite direction and ban it entirely, which many states have either done, had ready to go with what were referred to as trigger laws that said inside the context of the law that if Roe is ever overturned, this law will kick in within 15 or 30 days after the law, after the case is decided. Or now a number of state legislatures are going back to the drawing board and either recrafting new laws to restrict a woman's right to choose, or resurrecting old laws. Mississippi, the case where, the state where Dobbs is, had imposed a 15-week ban on a woman's right to choose, saying that anything that occurs after 15 weeks, we can restrict. Mississippi wins the Supreme Court case and then says, well, we have this law, but now we're going to go back to an older law that says that, that we already had on the books, that says that we're going to ban abortion entirely, except in the cases of rape and to save the life of the mother. So now it is both a federal issue and a state's question.
And the overturning of this, it means, and you just mentioned a couple of things, is that in the case of rape or in case of other instances, mm-hmm. Abortion basically is, in those states with the trigger laws, is automatically banned.
It depends on the individual state. Again,
right,
there are
the language and the legislation itself. Yes.
It would say it inside. There would be certain exceptions written in, but a number of the states that we're talking about don't have any restrictions at all, or any exceptions at all. Where regardless of whether it is rape or incest or to save the life of the mother or any other, right. Sometimes these types of procedures, abortive procedures, taken later on in the pregnancy, are meant to resolve issues that could, help the mother, preeclampsia and things of that nature that, might result, or fetal abnormalities that, the fetus itself is incompatible with life and is causing harm to the mother, but, they still won't allow it because you have to get, under the view of some of these state legislatures, it's life, we're going to give it a chance, and if it doesn't happen, then so be it. But, that's that.
Let's talk about here in the Commonwealth.
Sure.
What could this decision change? What knee-jerk reactions could we see from this decision, this ruling?
Massachusetts is one of the 24 states right now that have in one way or another protected or preserved a woman's right to choose. Massachusetts in 2019 and 2020 codified the woman's right to choose with the Roe Act. Basically preserving a woman's right to choose up to 24 weeks. And at that point, they can begin to restrict it. But even after 24 weeks, a woman has the right to choose to terminate a pregnancy if there is a physical reason, attested to by a doctor, or just as importantly, an emotional or mental justification for doing that. If this would cause emotional distress to continue the pregnancy, a woman's allowed to do it. The Roe Act also scaled back the ability for folks to get, reproductive care from 18 to 16. You no longer need to go, if you're under the age of 18 prior to 2019, you would need to go get a court order in order to have a reproductive procedure done. Now it's back to 16. Just recently, I applaud Governor Baker for doing this and having the guts to do it, considering the folks that are on the other side in his party. The Dobbs decision was crafted at 10:10 a.m. and was released to the public at 10:10 a.m. At 10:25 a.m., Governor Baker signed a series of executive orders and implored the Massachusetts House on Beacon Hill to engage in a number of legislative acts that would further protect a woman's right to choose, not just the woman's right, but also providers here in the state. And that's tremendously important. Because we're one of these states that has protected this right to choose, people are going to come from other states. And we talked about knee-jerk reactions. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people that are going to come into Massachusetts to get this kind of care. From the woman's right to choose is well protected from Maine all the way to Virginia. You know, with the exception of New Hampshire that tried to do something with fetal ultrasounds and things of that nature, you know, a woman's right to choose is protected in all of the New England states, into New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and down into Virginia. Right at the border of Virginia, that's where it all stops. But there will be people coming in. And so there's these states that are not just prohibiting abortions, but also indicating that they will prosecute individuals who engage in them, like Texas, like Mississippi, and treat them as felons, and some would actually charge them as murderers. What the Mass House did was attempt to codify a number of protections for healthcare providers, pharmacists as well, because if you're going to try to make Plan B and other types of abortive contraceptive pills illegal, pharmacies and pharmacists are also protected from being prosecuted by other states. Law enforcement agencies in the Commonwealth under this new law would be prohibited from cooperating with other law enforcement or investigative agencies from states seeking to prosecute Massachusetts folks in state. It's a great deal of protection that's being provided. And that's what we're doing in our knee-jerk reaction. Ours is to protect these people because we believe in the right to choose here.
If folks are tuning in, we are having a conversation with Chris DiIorio, not only an attorney, but also as well studied in constitutional law. Interesting having this conversation right around the time of America's birthday, but I couldn't have thought of a better time in order to have this conversation. A couple more questions in our conversation here. And legislatively, can the Congress, can the President create legislation or have executive orders put in place to supersede the decision moving forward, whether it's with this president, with this body of Congress, or future?
Can the president do things? No. He can advise, with an executive order regarding the potential prosecution, but the federal government does not prosecute folks for these things, so it's not an issue that the DOJ would be involved in. Can Congress do something? They have the power to do it. In fact, the Women's Protection Act was something that has been passed in the House of Representatives for a number of sessions. It won't make it through the Senate. And that's the problem. Because the filibuster exists right now, you would need 60 senators to say that we're going to allow this to, we're going to vote to cloture for what's referred to as cloture and allow for the vote to be taken so that you can get a majority vote. That's the mistake that people make when they talk about the filibuster. You can't just stop the law from happening. What you're stopping is discussion. on the law. And if you're not going to debate it, then you can't have a vote on it. That's the rules in the Senate. And we have maybe, if you get all of the Democrats on board right now in this session, that would be 50. Senator Collins from Maine, Senator Murkowski from Alaska have both indicated that they are in favor of women's right to choose. They are right now working with a couple of Democratic senators to try to craft some sort of legislation that might be passable in the Senate. It's unlikely, however, that you'd be able to pull another. I don't know where the other eight senators would come from that would allow for the, you know, bypassing the filibuster. So can they do it? Yes. Will they do it? Extremely unlikely in this iteration of the Senate, unless after the midterms. We have a couple of more senators. If you know, Democrats hold the Senate and pick up a couple of extra seats, perhaps they get enough senators to vote to carve out for the filibuster specifically to deal with this, or to eliminate the filibuster entirely, which would allow for a vote to take place. But again, that would remain for after November.
We have a final question, and I feel that this one probably has it's this depth to it, because first and foremost, we're talking about what ifs, and usually those are difficult to talk about. But there have already been concerns voiced by pundits that the Supreme Court could look to go after other landmark decisions.
Yeah.
Have you heard the same thing? And is there any concerns that there are other things that could be in the works?
There are concerns, obviously. And if you look at the rationale of the majority decision, that's part of where it comes from. Justice Alito, in writing the majority decision, said that due process is what we're talking about when we're dealing with a woman's right to choose. And that because due process is enshrined in the Constitution itself, both in the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment, but some people believe that due process simply means that you have to have a process in place before you can take someone's life or liberty away. What he referred to, though, is saying that we will only protect these fundamental rights if they have been traditionally enshrined in America's history, or if they're protected somewhere else in the Constitution. And in looking at the Constitution itself, abortion is not mentioned. Women are also not mentioned, nor is any other things, but slavery is. That's a story for another day. But so he's saying that you can't, that abortion is not protected in the Constitution, period. But he also took great pains to say to the majority that this rationale should not be meant to address other issues where due process might exist. Justice Clarence Thomas, in a dissenting opinion, however, sort of pulled the curtain back on the great and powerful Oz as far as the ideology on the court is concerned, in indicating that he believes that substantive due process does not exist, and that we should then go in the future and look at cases where substantive due process was utilized, specifically referring to Lawrence versus Texas, a case dealing with same-sex coupling and whether you're allowed to criminalize people who are involved in same-sex relationships. Loving versus Virginia, which he didn't mention for, I'm sure, reasons close to his own heart, but dealing with the right to marry someone outside of your own race. The Obergefell versus Hodges decision, which dealt with enshrining the right to same-sex marriage, otherwise known as marriage. But all of these things were decided on substantive due process grounds. And if, as Justice Thomas surmised, and as the logic from the majority decision opened up the door to, if we only protect those rights that are fundamental to our previous history, or if we don't agree that due process exists at all substantively, then there was no traditional right to a same-sex marriage. There was no traditional right to an interracial marriage. There was no right to same-sex Congress and you know, relationships and things of that nature. All of those things are potentially at risk. Those things could go out the door with this current rationale. That's the spreading out of what Dobbs and its logic could do in the future, especially if we get what Justice Thomas wants to happen.
Well, I guess it remains to be seen as to whether these will be next for the American public to keep an eye on and anticipate a decision being handed down. We want to thank you for at least giving us the breakdown as to the recent decision by the Supreme Court, and also sharing your expertise with the audience.
Kevin, thank you very much for having me.
I want to thank you out there in the radio land for tuning in to Monday Night Talk so religiously for over 10 years. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great night.